is up, everybody? Welcome to the Two Woke Nerds podcast. Thank you so much for listening this week. And like we say every week, if you like what we do, give us a review on iTunes, leave us a rating. It really helps with visibility. Share this with a friend, whoever it may be, someone you love, or if you don't like us, somebody you hate, maybe. Check us out on iTunes or wherever you find us, guys. Thank you so much for listening. You heard his illustrious voice, but I'm joined this week, like I am every week, by my good friend, my very own Vanilla Bear. A man who is still extremely hopeful about Gambit being made, Raymond Summerlin. Ray, how are you doing, bud?
I am not at all hopeful. You sent me a link today in our text chain that said that something about they're still really excited about the potential of making a Gambit movie. I didn't open the link. All I responded with was a all caps LOL, because it's not happening. And maybe me saying this, like maybe me vehemently saying there's never going to happen, is going to work just like Venom, and we'll actually get it like 3 minutes after we post this. It'll come out and say, hey, everybody's on board, Channing Tatum's ready to go. But yeah, I think he's going to make that like that stripper movie over and over again for the rest of his life, and then they're never going to make Gambit.
There are two things I want to unpack from what you just said. One, is that what Channing Tatum sounds like to you in your mind?
This is hey guys, I'm Channing Tatum.
He sounds like Mickey Mouse. And two, I think our podcast just exists to get things made.
Yeah, like, exactly.
We got Venom made.
Yes, we did. I take full credit for that, by the way.
And we got Arrival Oscar nominations, because you said it was going to be bad.
That's true.
And it was nominated for several Oscars, so I think... if we say enough times Gambit's not happening, it's not going to happen. Ron Perlman's never going to play Hellboy again. Send it on the air.
Logan will not be nominated for an Oscar. No not, chance he gets nominated for an Oscar.
No
Mark
chance.
It down. Send me my check.
But what we're going to talk about this week, we've got a couple of news stories, but our big topic for the week, I don't know if you've heard, there's this little movie.
Indie flick.
It's actually a period piece.
That's true.
It takes place in you know, foreign countries over in Britain. Now, Wonder Woman, guys, came out this past weekend. Ray and I both had an opportunity to see it, and so we will break down, talk about it. Surprise, surprise, we have a difference of opinions about certain aspects of Wonder Woman. If you've listened to our show before, you may not be surprised by that, if you couldn't tell the sarcasm. But we are going to start. We saw yesterday an interview with CinemaBlend. Star Wars Episode 9 director Colin Trevorrow went on record, and they were asking him, he's actually doing press for his current movie, The Book of Henry, but it's hard to talk to the man who's directing the next Star Wars film about anything other than Star Wars at this point. They asked him about how he was going to deal with the death of Carrie Fisher. She was slated to be a big part of the film, and so his quote was, she's a major character, it's not a secret. It's really sad for all of us. Here's where it gets interesting. I feel like our options are limited mostly by ourselves, and that there are only certain things that we are willing to do. So she was scheduled to be a big part of it. Kathy Kennedy actually said a month ago that they basically had to go back to the drawing board. So, Ray, what do you think? How do you think they should handle Carrie Fisher being a big part of the movie and now not being a big part of Star Wars Episode 9?
Well, I think that the first thing is I'm happy they're not going to CGI her. I think we saw with Tarkin that it was awkward. And they're not going to try to do that for an entire movie. And it seems like they respect her, the person Carrie Fisher, too much to go through and to do that, which is certainly promising, and I like that. You know, what I would say is that I don't believe there's been any photography done on this movie before she passed away, but she can play a role without actually being on screen, right? You can mention Leia's name. You can maybe use some old footage that they had for the other movies or something like that. And you can kind of write her a proper send-off. Maybe not as proper as you would like, but a proper send-off. But the point is that you don't have to be on screen to be felt in a movie. And I'm sure that the character will operate in that way. Just as I'm sure Han Solo is going to be. You know, obviously it's a different situation because Harrison Ford is still alive, but the character is dead. Han Solo's going to be a big part of Episode 8, I imagine, at least play some role in Episode 8, not because he's going to be on screen, but because, you know, the last event of you know, A New Hope Part Two kind of led to it. So I think that there are ways to do that. But I mean, like they said, they have to start over. This is a big shock. She was going to be the legacy character that was, you know, the most important one, and now this is, you know, they're faced with a big problem. Not only that, I mean, you lose when I remember when I was watching the interviews for the first Star Wars, or for this last one, for A New Hope Part Two, that
you almost called it The Force Awakens.
I almost did, but Carrie Fisher was such an important part of their rollout, of their press tours. And she seemed to be such a galvanizing force for the cast. I remember watching her on the Graham Norton show, which, by the way, is the best talk show in the world, bar none. Graham Norton show on BBC is fantastic. But she was on there, and Boyega was on there, and Ray was on there, and she was kind of like tying them all together, and she was like pointing at them and telling them to tell stories, because she's just this Carrie Fisher was just this larger than life personality and character, almost in the way that Mark Hamill is in some respects, although he does it in more reserved fashion, but still in that respect. But she was such an important part of the cast. I you know, you lose that on set, you lose her character, and it's such a big loss, and it does worry me a little bit, you know, not to diminish her, you know, dying, obviously, which I think you could tell is we're beat up a little bit about still.
Just a little bit.
It's still terrible. But I think that it damages this franchise moving forward as they try to finish out this trilogy. And I think it's going to be a big obstacle.
Yeah. And I think the one of the bigger obstacles in my mind is Episode 8 is in the can, essentially.
Yeah.
And so how do they remedy any sort of loose ends that are created in that film? It's set to be the bridge of a trilogy, so there's obviously going to be some loose ends that are not tied up. So that's really what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, John Boyega is going to be in Carbonite at Jabba's place. So like,
John Boyega is clearly Leia. Let's be honest here.
No, he's going to be Carbonite, for sure.
He's going to be in Carbonite.
There's
You're
not
saying
a
him
doubt
over
in
Oscar
my,
Isaac.
There's not a doubt in my mind. Yeah,
like Oscar Isaac ends up in Carbonite, but no. So how do they tie up those loose narrative ends? What do they do? And, you know, they say, you know, you can do something with her being off screen, but the way the character is written, and honestly, the way Carrie Fisher would want that character to be portrayed, she's all up in the mix.
Yeah.
Like, she's not one to sit on the sideline. She's not one to hide on a base somewhere. She is all up in the mix of everything. And so for me, I'm curious to see how they do it, because obviously it's going to be really well done. It's obviously going to be very respectful, but I can't think of a practical way, a story way to do it. Now, granted, these people are much more creative. They're better writers than I am. They're smarter than I am, very clearly. So I'm sure they're going to do something fantastic with it. But I just don't know what that is at this point. And nothing in my Star Wars mind makes sense at this point.
Yeah. Like I said, I think they're in a tough position. I don't know what they're going to do. I kind of trust them because I like what happened with Rogue One after it was clearly broken and they went in and fixed it. So I think that there's this could be good. Rian Johnson seems like he knows what's up. So I'm liking this. I mean I'm not liking it. I feel like they're going to be able to fix it and do it right, but it's still a big concern.
Sticking with things that are kind of concerning, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. If you can go back, you can listen to our episode about how we didn't really think Fantastic Beasts was all that fantastic. But we got some news today, this morning as of recording, from Pottermore, J.K. Rowling's official website, which feels just silly to say.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers has put out a casting call for the Fantastic Beasts sequel, looking for four specific actors to play the teenage incarnations of Newt Scamander, Leela Lestrange, Gellert Grindelwald, and Albus Dumbledore. So they're looking for actors between 13 and 16 to play Newt and Leela, and between 16 and 18 to play Grindelwald and Dumbledore. So all four, we're going to see some sort of flashback, or we're going to see even more history in a film that's all about wizarding history. So Ray, as someone who may not be as steeped in the Harry Potter lore, but does love making a good Voldemort joke every now and again, what are your thoughts, feelings, opinions, concerns even about this casting call? What are you most excited about even?
The thing that I am most excited about, because you're right, I'm not as steeped in the history of this universe, so I don't really have many thoughts about this. My only overriding thought is the more time they're in the past, the less time that Johnny Depp will be on screen. And that seems like a win for me. So I support this wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I think Johnny Depp was one of the worst things about that film. That switch was just so unnecessary. It's so terrible. I hated it. But one of the things that really interests me about this, I'm a huge Harry Potter nerd, as among all the other things I'm a huge nerd in favor of. But that time where Grindelwald and Dumbledore were friends, you know, it's basically like if Churchill and Hitler were friends as children. Like, that's what it is. And so what does that look like? What's that relationship? How did that dissolve? I'm interested to see if they do the wand duel, the wizarding duel between the two of them that's so fabled that possibly cost Dumbledore his sister's life and or sanity. So I'm interested to see that. It's an interesting piece of Harry Potter lore that I'm sure my wife, who's a huge Harry Potter fan, bigger Harry Potter fan than I am even, is super excited to see. She got really excited about it. So yeah, I love that they're using this series to fill out the backstory. I hope they do some more value-added things, for lack of a better term, in whatever Fantastic Beasts 2 turns out to be, because it seemed like Fantastic Beasts 1 just kind of spun its wheels until the reveal that wasn't that good, which is, again, one of my biggest problems with that movie.
But didn't that duel come... All right, so the final duel came in like the 40s, right? Where he eventually sent him to the prison...
Azkaban.
No, he went somewhere else. Grindelwald was somewhere else, I think, when Voldemort found him, like Nuremberg, something like that. Start with an N, I know that. Kind of looks like Nuremberg, which I guess maybe was purposeful. But so that first one with his sister and his brother, and they don't really know who ended up killing, or I guess that one. So that one was before kind of what we saw in Fantastic Beasts.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it came when they were teenagers.
Oh, that's interesting. Kind of had a falling out. That's interesting. So is she going to be a part of this then? That would be an interesting backstory for Dumbledore, for sure, who I obviously is one of the most interesting and most important characters in the whole world.
Yeah, so it's, for me, it's any fleshing out of those backstories is a good thing, and that's why I'm really excited about the future of this franchise, even though the first film was not that great.
Yeah, but you know, Eddie Redmayne,
It's hard to pass up Eddie Redmayne.
He's good. So I put faith in it, right?
But guys, with that out of the way, that brings us to today's main topic. So Wonder Woman was released this past weekend, shattering records box office wise as far as female directors, female led films, shattering expectations. I think it was expected to make somewhere in the range of what, 60 mil?
Yep.
And it capped out at more than 100 mil.
Yep.
Shattering expectations as far as the DC Extended Universe goes, because nothing in the DC Extended Universe has been good up until this point. So the fact that this was even decent shattered those expectations. So let's just jump right in, guys. Before we do this, if you have not seen Wonder Woman, we are going to run all up and down every possible spoiler you could possibly think of. So get ready for that. If you haven't seen it, you're one of one people in my social circle that hasn't seen it. So pause the podcast right now, go to your local cinema, check it out, and then pick this back up on your way home. But Ray, what were your overall thoughts about Wonder Woman?
Well, I think you made the kind of overarching point is that it wasn't a high bar to jump for a DC movie to be considered a success, right? That it was a plot that didn't seem disjointed. It had mostly good performances. It seemed to have a driving idea behind it, and it was mostly well done. And all of those things together that makes it, you know, a solid B-plus movie, which I think it's more than that, but I was just saying if it was just those things, it'd be a solid B-plus movie. That is still way better than anything the DCEU has put out, the post-Nolan DC universe has put out. So I think that in that regard, saying that it's, you know, the best one of this kind of generation is not really saying much. I think it was more than that. I thought that the action sequences were interesting. They were kind of innovative in a way, even though it feels like we've seen that before. It felt like some of the movements they were doing, some of that kind of time-lapse stuff, that Max Payne stuff, was was interesting, and it was a little bit different than what I had seen before, especially that beach scene early in the movie. That beach scene early in the movie was really, really cool. Them coming down the cliffs with the arrows, all of that was great. I really thought that first part of the movie, aside from the accents, which I could have done without, but aside from those, you know, they were all great. So I was completely in on that. And then I think the story, and we can get to this, I'll let you say your thoughts. I think the kind of overarching main idea of the story is an interesting and almost important one in the world that we live in. And so one that I think goes against some of the kind of prevailing themes of what people think being American is about. And I think that it's, you know, this kind of individualistic cult. And I think that that's a really interesting thing to put into a popcorn summer blockbuster. And that they did that and that they did it successfully really kind of puts this movie on a different pedestal for me. And so those are kind of my overarching thoughts.
I would call your reaction mixed positive. I think my reaction is flat mixed. I think there's a lot of good that happened in this film. I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of good things that happen. Like you said, the action sequences, you know, when they liberate that town, like that's some of the best action I think I've seen in quite some time. I love that sequence. I love just how inventive it was. The cinematography of her getting up out of the trench onto the battlefield, like the striking just juxtaposition of like the bright colors of her uniform and the drab background, like that was fantastic.
And
I
the
love
score,
that.
Like the score, they nailed it, which is something that we really haven't seen that. But that riff, and obviously it was in Batman versus Superman, but that riff is really cool. I think they nailed that for sure.
I think that riff hit in one awkward spot, but outside of that, it was pretty good. I loved at the end of the film, they did kind of like an orchestral cover of that riff that I thought was cool. I did think when she was when she jumped through the window and was just like owning those German soldiers, I thought that was really cool, but I thought that was where they misplayed the guitar riff because it should have felt more. That was like her big heroic moment. It should have felt better than... It's just kind of my bad interpretation of that film. But for me, it was good, but it was uneven at points. I think for every moment in the small town on the front, there was the bad CGI battle with Remus Lupin. Yeah. Like that, to me, for every moment like that, there was a really terrible moment where the CGI was weird or the acting just didn't quite hit. Like, I think Gal Gadot did a great job with what she was given. I think some spots were kind of awkwardly written for her. But one of the things I really appreciated about it, and this will kind of transition us to our next piece, I think one of the things that I really loved is that anytime you see one of these like fish out of water, like someone from ancient times, especially if it's a female character, they're always really good at a lot of things, but they struggle with love. Like that was a cool moment where she was on the boat and she basically said, "No, I understand pleasure and men are not required for that." Like they did some really cool things subverting the stereotypes of these movies that we've seen so many times. So Ray, what was your favorite part about the film? What did you like the most? What stands out to you the most? Just jump in and what do you think? What was your favorite part about this film?
I really liked when she was in London, how the men just simply couldn't handle women, like even like their presence. That was such a fun kind of knife turn for me that I really enjoyed. Like I loved it. They were just like just befuddled by a woman being in the room with them. I enjoyed that immensely. My favorite part of it was the message of the entire like what a superhero is, right? And Batman hit on this a lot. The Nolan Batmans hit on this a lot, and I think it's a really important idea. And Chris Pine said it obviously to Wonder Woman. She repeats it in that battle with Remus. But I agree with you on that point. We can talk about that point, and that's probably my biggest negative is how they handled that. But this, it's not about deserve, right? We shouldn't be helping these people because they deserve it. We should be helping these people because it's what we believe is the right thing to do. And that's such a collectivist idea that is being packaged in the most capitalistic and individualistic of ways. One is summer blockbuster, and that's a really interesting juxtaposition to me. This idea that we can have this movie that makes $100 million in its opening weekend that is basically built on the idea that we should help people not because they deserve it, but because that's what good people do and we want to be good people, which obviously flies in the face of the entire political situation that we're facing in the American government, at least at this point in time, and in the British government in some ways, although they have an election coming up soon. We'll see what happens. It doesn't seem to be going the right way for old Theresa May, but we'll see what happens. I think that this idea, the fact that they packaged it in this way, that's really interesting to me. It's very, I don't want to use this word because this word is not the right word, because there are actual people who do brave things every day in uniforms, and I don't want to say brave, but I don't know what other word to use. Say maybe ambitious. Maybe that's a word to use. It's an ambitious to do that in a movie of this scale. And I think that it really hit me. I walked out of that movie and that's the line that hit me. It's not about deserve. That's the line that I took with me. And I think that that's a really important kind of point to take out of this movie. And obviously they're not the first one to say this. Like I said, Nolan's Batman had a lot of that in it as well. But I think it's a really important point. And it's one of those things that makes me kind of notch it up a level and say, okay, this is something that's a little more important than your normal popcorn movie.
Yeah, and I think it had a lot to say about the true nature of heroism.
Yeah.
It had a lot to say. I think the conversation that she has with her mother on the island about, like, how can we stand by and watch this happen? Like, that conversation to me is kind of everything that the DCEU has tried to bend up until this point. They've tried to make, you know, commentary on what heroism is. They've tried to make commentary on what it means to stand up for what you believe in, and it's kind of all fallen flat. I think back to Man of Steel and the weird things that movie tried to say. I think back to that, and this movie finally hit on those themes, and so that is something that I really enjoyed. You know, another thing I really enjoyed was, again, huge spoiler alert, the reveal that the villain that she had been chasing throughout this entire journey was not who she thought she was, and the reveal that the actor, I legitimately am just going to call him Remus Lupin, that Remus Lupin this whole time had been who she should have been chasing. Like, that reveal, that whole conversation about, you know, what is war? Why do we engage in war? You know, what is it? Is it my doing, or is it just human nature to do this, and do I just put them in these positions to do these evil things? And so that was a really interesting conversation, interesting moment for me. I really wish they had done more with that idea and done more with that style of resolution. I think it would have been, again, even just as ambitious as the message they were trying to say if they had not done the big CG slugfest at the end, which was the weakest part of the film, in my opinion. It was not a good way to resolve a film that had tried to make such bold statements, that had tried to make such big, heady concepts and put them in a superhero film. So, Ray, you know, that's what I feel like the weakest part. For, in your mind, what do you think the weakest part of the film was? What kind of sticks out at you?
I'm gonna go further than you about that. Ares being real at all. I didn't like that. I was perfectly content whenever she slammed that sword through the German, and that she realized that Ares, or she thought for a moment that Ares didn't exist. I thought that that was the perfect way to end it. I thought that's how it should have gone. This idea that humans, we can do evil all by ourselves. We don't need a driving force. We don't need someone whispering in our ear. We have that inside of us, and it's up to us, to the good ones, or even our battles that we fight inside ourselves, to have the good rise above evil. That is a much more interesting idea to me than, oh, by the way, there is this Greek god that's running around whispering in people's ears, even though they tried to fix that idea with what he said. I'm not actually making this happen. I'm not blah, 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 blah. I'm not doing this. But ultimately, he was there, right? He was whispering those things into the chemist's ear. I think that was unnecessary, and I much rather like the idea that humans are doing this by themselves, because we all have that in us, and it's up to us to rise above it. And that idea is far, far more interesting to me than watching, like you said, that CGI battle with Remus.
Yeah, and I think it would have suited what the movie was trying to say far better than that resolution of her seeing the heroic sacrifice of Steve Trevor and seeing all these things happening, and that being the force that kind of catalyzes her to overcome, when in actuality she should have just decided, well, even though Ares isn't real, saving people is the right thing to do. Fighting injustice is the right thing to do. So that would have been a much more powerful thing. And something to me whispers a little bit of studio interference with it. I feel like Patty Jenkins probably wouldn't have gone that direction under her own thoughts, feelings, and direction. Perhaps I think a lot of that may have been, well, it is a superhero film, so we have to have a big punch up at the end. But my questions then become, where do we go from here? You know, there's a story out in Forbes about how DC and Warner Brothers, they're not going to be cranking these things out 3 a year like Marvel. Because Warner Brothers does other movies. Warner Brothers has other things going on. So we know that Patty Jenkins is back for Wonder Woman 2. We know that Gal Gadot is back for Wonder Woman 2. So, Ray, where do we head from here? Because there are a lot of unanswered questions still. There are a lot of unanswered questions. If Ares was real, what happened to the other gods? I mean, Zeus is still around. What's going on? Where is Steve Trevor actually dead? You know, there are a lot of unanswered questions here. So Ray, where do you want to see them go with the sequel? What would be a good sequel to this film to you?
Well, I think they said in the story that Zeus died, and the last thing he did was gift them Wonder Woman. So I think that Zeus is gone. I think that all of the gods are gone. The Greek gods at least are gone. We can get into an American gods conversation here in a bit, but the Greek gods are gone. So I think that if these are like the messages of your movie and what you're trying to build out of Wonder Woman, then there's no better time than the present to try to take those things, right? Her speech on the island, that how can we sit here and do nothing, is a perfect answer to the question of isolationism, right? How can we close off our borders and do nothing while other people suffer? So this not about deserve, that's a perfect answer to individualism. It's so I think that there's no better time than now. And I do believe that after Justice League, that's kind of where we're going to be set up. We're going to be set up in the present and in this kind of darker world that, by the way, this darker world that we're currently living in fits DC more than the cheery, bright colors of Marvel, which might give them an opportunity to really, you know, gain a foothold in this. And so we'll see what happens with Justice League, obviously. But I think that that's much more interesting. But again, to your point, do they actually want to build a universe anymore? Is a really good question. There was no post credit after this movie. There wasn't one after Suicide Squad last time. Is that because Justice League is 2/3 being redone? Or are they getting out of this game? Obviously, they're going to make Wonder Woman 2 because it was a success, but is Aquaman going to get made? You know, is The Flash going to get made? It's interesting to see what they're going to do, and if maybe the success of this movie kind of, not just financial, because obviously the other movies had financial, Suicide Squad made a ton of money, Batman vs. Superman made a ton of money. The critical success of this movie, does it kind of rejuvenate what they're trying to do in the universe that they're thinking about? I don't know. I think it would if I was working on it, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, I think, and that was that Forbes article I referenced, was they're not going to make huge moves until after Justice League. It's not really, obviously they're going to look at the performance, and if Justice League flops, and they're going to do something different. But I don't think that's going to happen, especially with the way Wonder Woman has been received. I think when we watch, I would be curious to watch what Justice League promotions look like moving forward. I think we're going to see a lot more of Diana Prince in these Wonder Woman advertisements. I think they might as well,
because Gal Gadot is a star.
She's going to be the face of the franchise. I think they're going to move past Affleck. I think he's great. He's great Bruce Wayne, but I don't think he's going to be the face of the franchise anymore. I think Gal Gadot is going to continue to be the face of the franchise. And so I think that's the direction. And honestly, if Wonder Woman becomes the central piece of the DCEU, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
I thought this movie was cool, even though it sometimes was a retread of Captain America, the First Avenger. It felt that way a lot in some spots.
Purposefully, I think, as well.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. I mean, it was good. But no, I think that to me is an interesting way to go. Because, you know, outside of Flash and Aquaman, the next two films that are greenlit in the DCEU are Gotham City Sirens,
yeah.
which is Catwoman, Poison Ivy, and everybody's favorite Harley Quinn, and Batgirl.
And let's be very honest, Sirens is really just an avenue. It's really just an engine for Margot Robbie. That is why that's happening. Because of Margot Robbie was the standout of Suicide Squad.
Yeah, and she's the EP on that movie. She's executive producing that film. So she's the reason why that's happening. But again, outside of those two other tentpole films, you know, Flash and Aquaman, because they kind of have to make them at this point. They're already in pre-production for both of those, even without a director on the Flash.
Yeah.
You know, Gotham City Sirens is going to happen because people want Harley Quinn. Even though that movie wasn't good, Harley Quinn action figures are still a thing. And, you know, last Halloween, Harley Quinn was one of the top-selling Halloween costumes, so people want that. And anytime you attach Joss Whedon's name to anything, people are going to clamor to see it, especially something as unique as Batgirl. So, again, if DC becomes the home for powerful women in comic book films, I'm all for it, because Marvel is slow playing it, is the best way I can describe it. I mean, Captain Marvel is on its way, but it's still several years out. But outside of that, like, we've wanted fans have been clamoring for a Black Widow film since the Avengers, and it still hasn't happened.
It doesn't seem like it's ever going to happen either.
I don't think so. Well, maybe now after the success of Wonder Woman, we may start seeing more people fall in line with that. But guys, that brings us to the best segment on the show. Your favorite segment, my favorite segment, your grandmother's favorite segment. Don't sleep on it. So, Ray, what can the good folks at home not sleep on this week?
Well, my week started out well. Monday morning, there was a wedding of a good friend this weekend. And so Monday morning, for reasons you can probably surmise, was rough for me. But what I found was the Joshua Tree Super Deluxe box set on my iTunes by U2. I would always recommend Joshua Tree. I think it's the best four-song start to any album that I have ever heard. I know you're going to push back on that, Gerald, but I absolutely... Yeah, go ahead and say the one that you're going to say.
Illmatic.
There you go. I know. And you know that I will rep that album all the time, but I love those four songs. And by the way, the first seven on Joshua Tree are all legitimately great. But this is a cool release because it has a previously unreleased album, concert from, I believe, Madison Square Garden. It has some remixes in it, a bunch of other cool stuff. But U2 does not need me to sell their album. So I'm not bringing it up for that. Obviously, if you're a YouTube fan, go and find it. I love U2. Go and sorry, Scrubs references come in here. Go in there and absolutely get it. But I do want to point out, I hadn't listened to Joshua Tree, I guess, in a couple of years, and it's amazing to me how fresh that record still sounds today. It's kind of in the Goldilocks period of U2. It's past that kind of proto or post-punk stuff that they were doing in the early 80s. It's before the nonsense that started with, you know, Rattle and Hum in the 90s. It's before all of that nonsense. And then it's before all that stuff. So it's right there in the sweet spot. And what they managed to do, why I think the Joshua Tree is one of my favorite albums of all time, and I will always say that's one of the best ones I've ever heard, is they managed to make a record which would sound fresh at any time. It sounds like it could have been from the 70s, obviously from the 80s, 90s. I mean, Counting Crows, you know, belting out those songs, like that wouldn't sound odd to you. It sounds like it could have been made today. It's just a really, really special accomplishment, I think, to be able to make a record like that. And going through and listening to it, again, just, you know, reminded me of that and how much I love it. One of my favorite albums of all time. If you haven't listened to it, I'd obviously recommend it highly. And I'm sure that Gerald is going to just roll his eyes and give me nothing but nonsense about that.
No, it's fine. I've never been a U2 guy. I respect what they have done for music and rock and roll music. I think that Bono is a star and he's used his platform for good. I've just never been a U2 guy. You're entitled to your opinion.
Yeah.
I'm not there. Again, best four song album opener to me is always going to be Illmatic. Like, it is what it is. It always will be. I'm sorry, Ray. I've got New York in my roots, so I can't really do much about that.
Word is born, man.
But guys, my don't sleep. So my wife and I, if you're new to the show, if you don't know much about my situation, my wife and I have a 3.5-month-old son. He's awesome. Love him to death. But one of the things you do as a new parent is basically you sit on the couch between your kids' naps and you just hope and pray that they don't wake up early. And so my wife and I fly through some stuff on Netflix and Hulu, and we're just looking for something mindless the other night. It was late. He'd been asleep, but we weren't ready to go to bed yet. And so we stumbled upon a show on Hulu called First Dates. And First Dates is a terrible, terrible reality show that is all about setting people up on blind dates. And it honestly feels a bit like MTV in the early 2000s, except every episode they have kind of a really deep and poignant relationship and some people talking about some really, really interesting things about their relationship history and why they're dating in their current situation. There is there's a spot in the very first episode where two older people are getting out in the dating world after their spouses both passed away. And like hearing them talk about, you know, going through that life with somebody and trying to rebuild and start over and find some companionship really, really tugged at my heartstrings. The second episode had kind of a tasteless bait and switch with an older guy. But it turned out that he's a gay man, and he was on a date with another gay man. And, you know, that could be shocking to people, but the conversation they had and just them talking about their combined and mutual struggles as they came up in, you know, they're both in their 50s. So as they grew up in, you know, the 60s and 70s where you know, it's less tolerant than nowadays. That was, for me, an interesting conversation to listen to. So those conversations are the things that keep me coming back to First Dates. So First Dates, it's executive produced by Ellen. It's kind of trashy in spots, but there are some really cool moments where they have some people having really deep and human conversations. That's what keeps me coming back. So guys, don't sleep or continue to sleep on, if you so choose, on First Dates. It's on Hulu. But guys, that brings us to the end of the show today. If you like what you heard, you made it this far, clearly you probably did. Guys, leave us a review on iTunes. Leave us a rating. It really helps with visibility. Share it with your friends wherever you find it, Stitcher, iTunes. If you find us on the blog, share that with your friends. Put it on your Facebook. Do me a favor. You'd be a real, real friend to me if you did that. Ray, where can the good folks find you on the interwebs?
You find me at RM Summerlin on the Twitter. I think that I have a Facebook page, facebook.com/Raymond Summerlin. Remember when people used to say backslash all the time?
Yeah.
Do anybody say that anymore?
Not that I know of.
facebook.com/Raymond Summerlin.
I that was a very vehement backslash. Ray also has an Instagram that he's ashamed of.
I am deeply ashamed of my Instagram.
Guys, you can find me on Twitter. I am at GH Goodridge. You can find the show on Twitter. We are at Two Woke Nerds. If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet us there, or you can send us an email at twowokenerdspod@gmail.com. Guys, thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay woke.
Stay woke.